So everybody, hi, my name is Rachel Emma Silverman, and I'm a reporter at the Wall Street Journal covering management and workplace issues. And we're here for our session on your brain on multitasking. And I'm not only interested in the topic of multitasking professionally, but also personally as a mother of young children. I work from home and I work with a lot of distractions. So we are very, very lucky to have three renowned experts on multitasking who come from the perspectives of psychology, neuroscience, and time management. Our speakers here, will speak for a few minutes, and then I'll ask them a few questions, and then we'll take questions from you in the audience. Our first speaker on my right is David Meyer, a professor and researcher of cognitive psychology at the University of Michigan, who has done extensive and leading research on how multitasking affects our thinking. Adam Ghazali in the middle is an associate professor of neurology, physiology, and psychiatry at the University of California at San Francisco and a founding director of the Neuroscience Imaging Center there. And Peter Bregman is the CEO of consultancy Bregman Partners, and he's also a time management expert and the author, most recently, of 18 Minutes, Find Your Focus, Master Distraction, and Get the Right Things Done. So we're going to start here with David. Yep, we're good.
So I've been told I got to give a talk that lasts an hour and 7 minutes, and here goes. Listen up. It's going to be organized in terms of a bunch of questions that are absolutely crucial for understanding multitasking. I'm going to tell you some of those questions. You'll hear others later from the rest of the panel members. The first one is, what's a task? We need to ask that, because if you don't know what you're talking about, you won't understand anything that comes later. Answer. Task is a procedure involving a sequence of mental and physical processes for achieving a desired goal. Mental and physical processes that are involved with this would include perception, memory retrieval, response selection, movement production, a whole bunch of other stuff that goes on in your head and body when you're trying to get a task done, such as the ones you see here, ranging from folding laundry to mowing lawns to doing texting on cell phones and finally thinking about trying to solve interesting problems of one sort or another. Of course, that raises the second question, which involves what's multitasking. You may not like this answer, but I'm going to give it to you anyway, which is trying but not always succeeding to perform multiple tasks either simultaneously or by switching rapidly back and forth between them. Example, cell phoning, driving, and drinking coffee all at the same time, tending pets, emailing and doing computer messages, watching your kids while you're washing dishes, and so on and so forth. That leads to a third question, namely, is multitasking good or bad? I bet most people here think it's mostly good. I hope you're going to wind up thinking it's not exactly so clear whether it's good or bad after you hear all of what's said today. That's because the answer all depends on what your tasks and goals are. Fact, efficient simultaneous multitasking is possible for simple, well-practiced, compatible tasks under some circumstances. Examples, walking and chewing gum, except in the case of Gerald R. Ford, who was reputed not to be able to do even that. It's an issue whether or not George W. Bush could do it, but in any case, most of us can, as well as folding laundry and listening to the radio, like for the weather report. Those are examples of well-practiced compatible tasks. On the other hand, you have the fact that conflicting tasks require inefficient, potentially hazardous task switching, even if they're highly familiar. Example, emailing and trying to do schoolwork at the same time, or cell phoning and driving. That then leads to further crucial questions. I don't know where I am here. I think I've probably taken 3 minutes out of my 60. How are the mind and brain related to these facts about multitasking? Bregman, you were supposed to call me on my phone to illustrate how I can't do both at the same time. Too late now because you were multitasking. How are the mind and brain related to these facts about multitasking? Answer is, each task involves using neural channels of information processing in your brain. For example, we know in particular that there are separate language and visual manual channels that you have in your brain for both your right and your left hemispheres. Fact, each of these channels has limited capacity. Fact, conflicting tasks therefore compete with each other for the same channels, whereas compatible tasks don't. What that then means is if you have two tasks that are using different channels, you can simultaneously multitask pretty efficiently. But if you've got conflicting tasks, then you're going to have to multitask through the use of various kinds of more or less sophisticated task scheduling strategies. Very key concept, task scheduling strategies. If you learn nothing else here today, you should learn that you need to find out more about what's known with respect to task scheduling strategies. Here's a little bit more of an illustration of various kinds of information processing channels in the human brain. You have, for example, a language channel that's used while listening to the radio. You have a visual manual channel that's used, for example, when you're folding laundry. Because those two channels are separate from each other, don't overlap or compete, you can actually do those tasks simultaneously pretty well. On the other hand, if you've got two tasks like cell phoning and texting, or driving that each use the language channel, and I'm asserting to you, driving uses the language channel pretty much as in the same way that cell phoning and texting does. If you want to know why, ask me later. Meanwhile, notice also the driving and cell phoning and texting also use the visual manual channel. What that means is that these tasks are heavy-duty competing with each other for the use of each of those channels, and as a result, we need executive cognitive control for task scheduling. And also, as a result of this, you're going to be relatively inefficient most of the time when you try to do those two tasks in parallel. That leads to question five, which is, how do we know all of this? Answer is, partly from results of controlled empirical laboratory research involving behavioral experiments, brain imaging, and testing brain-damaged patients. I won't ask whether or not there are any brain-damaged patients in the audience, but I would like to know if there's somebody here who thinks he or she is a super great multitasker. If you are, raise your hand. She raised her hand. Please stand up. Stand up. I'm going to show you an example of a simple behavioral demo. Do you know how to count from 1 to 10?
Yes.
Please do it as fast as you can when I say go. Go. She did that in about 2 seconds. Do you know your ABCs? Please say them from A through J when I say go, go. That's great. Now we're going to have you do some multitasking. She took 2 seconds for one task, 2 seconds for the other. Now we're going to have you do some task switching. I want you to do both of those tasks, except alternating back and forth. 1A, 2B, ready, set, go. You get the idea. She crashed and burned. This wonderful multitasker who claims she's so great can't be done because she's trying to do two tasks using exactly the same language channel. You may be seated and think about it more. We can perform such experiments in the lab under better controlled conditions using computers and brain imaging and so on and so forth to figure out exactly why people like her crash and burn, both figuratively and literally. Hopefully you won't, as a result of now having seen how hard it really is when you're exposed in public. Meanwhile, second answer to this fourth question is that we know about this in part also from results of computational modeling of human multitasking. For example, in cases where people are cell phoning and driving or operating aircraft cockpits. So here's an example of aircraft cockpit operation. Louder, please. There you go.
Come on, bring it right.
Well, this goes on for a while. If it had an hour, I'd show you the whole entire last segment. But the bottom line is that Maverick beats Jester. You get the idea. What we can do is build computational models of the physical and mental processes that are taking place in pilots' heads and bodies, like what you just saw here with Maverick. I don't have time to show you a running simulation, but if you want to see one later after the session, come up and I'll actually demonstrate it executing as opposed to just showing you a screenshot of part of what we can see and do when we're executing that sort of simulation. In doing such simulations, we can test out hypotheses with respect to the kind of task scheduling strategies that various more or less skilled individuals use when they're having to multitask under conditions like this. That's an example of what we call a cautious scheduling strategy, where there's relatively little overlap allowed between various mental and physical processes. That's an example of a daring scheduling strategy where more overlap is allowed. For each of these kinds of strategies, using modeling procedures, we can make predictions about what actual performance under conditions like Mavericks ought to look like. This is an example of results both from experimentation and model simulation, which basically show if you're a really good pilot, you can use daring scheduling strategies and perform pretty well. That's the black versus the green versus the red, which comes from a more cautious scheduling strategy. Final crucial question for right now is, what should you do about all of this? What you should do about all of this is you got to know your goals and your tasks. You got to do task analysis to identify which tasks are compatible or conflicting with each other. Based on that, you then need to choose optimal task scheduling strategies given whatever your goals, tasks, and multitasking skills are. And most important, given that we're in Austin, is you got to listen to Kenny Rogers and follow his advice about multitasking. You got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them, know when to walk away, know when to run. You never count your money while you're living, sitting at the... Sorry, I ain't no good at that. That's why I do this job as opposed to Kenny Rogers' job. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done. If you remember nothing else but that, you'll be much better off with respect to your multitasking, which brings us to Adam.
Thanks. Thanks, Kenny.
Can you hear me? Okay. We're moving on a tight schedule, so I'm going to keep us at that pace. So I hope you got used to it by, after that fantastic talk. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what's going on in your brain from the neuroscience perspective when you're multitasking, and tell you about some work, just a very quick summary of work in our laboratory at UCSF. So one thing we did was we recategorized interference, of which this falls into, to study how the brain works, usually under conditions while participants are inside an MRI scanner. So we divide interference into two main compartments based on where the interference is coming from. So we can either be internal interference or external. And then we divide those into other two categories based on your goal. So let's start with external interference. So there can be irrelevant information around you, and your goal is to ignore it. That's what we consider a distraction. You're at a restaurant, you're having a conversation, you're trying to shut down the chatter that's going on around you just so you can focus. Those are distractions. That same type of stimuli can be interruptions, and this is when you choose to do more than one task at a time. So you're engaged in one task, maybe you're at the restaurant, but now you're trying to listen to the waiter telling the dinner specials at the next table. So they could be the same stimuli, but distractions you're trying to ignore, and interruptions or multitasking, you're making the attempt to run more than one information stream at the same time. This can all occur internally too. You could have intrusions, mind wandering, or also try to multitask internally. So I'm going to tell you about just one experiment in the lab to display some of this, and it's the impact of both distraction and multitasking, these two types of interference and memory. We do the majority of our work in our lab on how those impact memory. So it's a very simple experiment. Here's how it goes. Over time, you see a face. 7 seconds pass and you see another face. And you just have to say, did this face match this one? Then we do another experiment where a face pops up in the middle. You're told beforehand this face is totally irrelevant. Your goal is just to ignore it and still go about matching this face over time. Then there's a third task where a face pops up in the middle. But in this task, you have to make a decision. Is this a male over under 20? And if we had time and I had you do this, you would actually feel that this one was a little bit more difficult. So if we look at this, and this is called working memory, holding information in mind for very short periods of time, between these conditions and younger adults, by that I mean healthy 20 to 30-year-olds, we see that there is a decrement in performance. It is subtle. This is not a very hard task. But even the distraction degrades performance consistently in almost every single person. If you happen to be a healthy 60 to 70-year-old, this is the pattern we see. Same pattern, but significant drops both across age groups. Older adults are more distractible, and they even have a larger negative impact of multitasking on their memory. The short-term memory, just holding something in mind. Has anyone ever went to go to the refrigerator only to arrive there and have no idea what you're doing? Let me see a show of hands, right? So y'all familiar with this. This is why this is occurring. This is usually a problem with interference. That interference may be external or may be internally generated, but you clearly have the capacity to hold a single item in mind for 7 seconds. This is where it breaks down. We did a whole series of experiments using brain recordings, both EEG and fMRI. I'm just going to give you a cartoon to summarize some of these data. This is how it's managed in your brain. Your prefrontal cortex in the sending of distraction acts as like the bouncer. It decides what information is on the guest list. It sends signals in these networks down to the visual parts of your brain that acts to actually represent that information. In reality, it's not a whole nightclub. It's really just a very exclusive restaurant with six people sitting there, right? You can only hold a very limited amount of information. If this bouncer fails in this job and too much information gets in here, you have interference and you have a cost and an impact on your performance. The same area of the brain is involved in multitasking, but here the prefrontal cortex is acting as a flight controller. It's deciding what is the priority right now. So let's say you happen to be crazy enough to be texting and biking in Manhattan next to a cab. Your brain might decide, okay, focus on the traffic, maybe a turn is coming up, and then decide, okay, it's time I could finish that text message. But what it doesn't do is this. Right? There is a bottleneck. The prefrontal cortex, when it has cognitive resources that compete, as we just heard, makes decisions. And this is what led many to think that multitasking is really a myth. When you have high demanding cognitive tasks that compete for resources, you switch between them, and you don't really multitask in the pure sense. So what we have here is a delay caused by those switchings and an impact on performance, if that performance competes for resources. Okay, we're now exploring multitasking in perception and action. So we did another experiment in our lab, very simple. I'm just giving you a little taste here. Here you had to do a simple detection task where you had to press the button as rapidly as possible when a green circle comes up. But if a green pentagon comes up or a red circle, you don't press the button. You withhold your response. You could do that under a single task condition or under a multitasking condition where you're also navigating a car on a road and doing the sign task. So here's a quick look of what this looks like. It's sort of a rudimentary video game that we created with help from friends in the industry to try to look. So you would press it for the green sign, not the other signs. But it actually demands quite a bit of resources to do them both. And then what we could do is for every person, we could calculate your cost of multitasking. And how we do that is just a simple equation. We look at how much your performance drops when you do on the sign task when you're also driving, and then divide it by your baseline sign performance. And it tells us how much your performance drops, the cost you take when you multitask. So we just did this across the lifespan. We went from 20-year-olds to 80-year-olds and have them play that game, come down to the lab. Zero would mean there's no cost. That means your ability to do the detection task is not at all affected by also driving the car. Here's who's 20 in this room in their 20s? Let's see who we're talking to here. Okay, here's what 20s should. 27% drop, right? These are healthy people. Granted, there are actually video game players were excluded from the study. That's a whole other study. It's actually very hard to find male 20-year-olds in San Francisco that do not play video games, but they're out there, and we found all 18 of them. And so 27% drop. What happens? What happens as we reach our 60s and 70s? Do you sort of just hold this ability and then start declining? That's not what happens. This is what happens. We actually have a very linear decline. This is unpublished data. We're actually writing this up right now, so it's still pre. But actually, the biggest significant difference between two decades of life are between 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds. And we're still trying to explore what that is, but you could see older adults have a very significant deficit here. We brought back another group of older adults, and we see that we were able to replicate it. They fell basically right on the top of that point. And then what we did is we had them go home and play this video game at home for 12 hours. They did 1-hour sessions over the course of a month. They had 3 hours a week they had to dedicate to this. And while they were playing at home, we were communicating that information right to a Dropbox account, right to our lab, and we could essentially watch them play this video game in real time in our lab while they played at home. And what we found was over this period of time, we brought them back to the lab, and we found that their cost was up here. significantly improved, up to now only 13% drop, and they had a significantly lower cost than the younger adults on their single visit. So this is unpublished data. This is work that we're working on right now. It's in progress, but it's quite encouraging, and what it shows is that with practice, adaptive training, this is an adaptive game, it gets harder as you get better, you can improve these abilities. We also are finding some transfer in this. Since interference impacts so many domains of our cognition and our performance, if we can boost it, we're hoping that we'll have large scale and broad impact of improving these abilities. So where do we go from here? We're now working with a new company that I'm helping to create called Achille that's just starting. And this is a prototype. I'm just going to give you the first sneak peek of it. But the idea is to try to take these concepts from the lab and turn them into actual products. It's going to be a mobile product. We're working with iPhone and iPad right now. And this is just a little look of it. I'm not going to go through too many details. But you'll see a lot of the same concepts again that you just saw in the more laboratory-based experiments. So gives us the ability to perform careful diagnoses to understand the multitasking class by engaging in a navigation and a targeting, to be able to look and to be able to place you in perspective of your friends, your population, and then to engage in something that is fun, interactive, immersive, but challenging these abilities to see if you can improve them over time. So this is the general goal. This is fun feedback. This is still a work in progress, and these are some of the sort of the adventures that that we're hoping to explore. All right. So anyway, that's my little quick tour through our lab, both the research and where we're hoping to bring this to products to improve quality of life and obviously keep you focused on one thing or doing two things well. Thank you.
So, am I too loud? No. All right, so we're going to start with a quick activity. I'm going to ask you to say a word 10 times. Then I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to ask you to answer that question as quickly as possible. You game? Okay, the word is silk. Silk, 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 silk. What does a cow drink?
Water.
Actually, water, yeah. So here's the thing. The thing is that we get into habits. You are in the habit of saying silk, 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 cow, you go to milk. It makes a lot of sense. You're in a habit. Multitasking is a habit. There's not a single person in here who doesn't multitask. Right? We all multitask. We've been taught to multitask. But what we're hearing is that multitasking is actually not that effective if it's an incompatible tasks. So the question is, how do we break ourselves of this habit? What we know is that self-control, discipline, not a very useful thing to rely on in terms of breaking the task. It won't work. It'll certainly maybe work in the first hour of the morning, but by the third hour and the fourth hour of the day, forget it. It's not going to work. Don't rely on self-control. What is the difference between these two pictures, the picture above and the picture below? The dishes of candy, that's it. So that difference, which is just about 4 or 5 feet, is the difference between eating the candy and not eating the candy. Right? That your behavior is dictated more than you think by your environment. We think we're in control, but in reality, it's our environment that controls most of what we do. And so the question from a multitasking perspective is, if you want to change your behavior in something that's a habit, the question is, the first thing to do is, what can you do to your environment that's going to make a difference in terms of your behavior? So the first thing you do if you don't want to multitask is that you take away the opportunities to multitask as much as possible. That means literally taking your phone, if you're driving, and putting it somewhere other than within your reach. And I don't mean within your reach like you're driving and you go to the back seat and you reach. That, let's consider that still within your reach a little more dangerously. You put it in your trunk, you put it somewhere else where you can't do it. If you're writing and you really want to write, however hard this is, and even though you sometimes need to go to the internet, you kill the internet connection. When I lost my internet connection because there was some technical difficulty, I got more writing done than ever, right? Because I'm not sort of checking my email and going. So you have to create these environmental changes in such a way to make it more likely that you're going to do the thing that you want to do and less likely that you're going to do the thing that you don't want to do. If you don't need your cell phone, meaning when I, for example, when I have three kids, when I go out with my kids and my wife, and I know that there's no one who has to reach me from an emergency, I'll leave my cell phone at home. Because I know that if I have my iPhone with me in a moment of boredom, and I'm bored a lot when I'm with my, I mean, my kids are great, but it's very easy. It's very easy to get bored. So I will I'll just take it out and I'll start texting because they're, you know, checking email and things like that. If you don't want to do it, you can't bring your phone. Otherwise, you will do it, I promise you. Okay, that's the first thing. So the first barrier is to say, create an environment that's going to make it less likely that you're going to do the things that you don't want to do. Okay? The second thing is now is to do less, right? To reduce what it is that you're doing. This is the to-do list that I use. I'm going to very, very quickly go over it, but it's what I call the six-box to-do list. The first five boxes are areas of focus that I want to move forward in the year, and I only pick five for a year, things that I really want to focus on for the year. And then the sixth box is everything else. And when I first started keeping a to-do list like this, everything fit into the other 5%. The only things I were doing were in the other 5%, because it's much easier to buy running sneakers than it is to write a chapter of a book. And so I'd much rather go look on the web and see, oh, well, look at all the research. There's a lot of research on running sneakers, if you've ever looked. So if you really want, so this way, every single day that I look at my to-do list, I'm looking at it in terms of the things that I most want to get done. And I keep along with this something I call an ignore list. Things that I know that I want to, and it's not just a to-do list, it's kind of like a not-to-do list. Things that I know I would distract myself from if I were to allow myself. And that's just a reminder of, you know what, I really don't want to go there right now. I don't want to work on that. So the second line of attack is reduce the number of things that you're going to do. The third is what I consider gamifying your work, right? That if I have a meeting that I know is going to take an hour, and I set it to 30 minutes, and I decide I'm just going to have 30 minutes for this meeting, suddenly, it becomes more interesting. Second of all, like us, we could each have taken an hour to give this talk, but we're taking 25, 30 minutes each. And what that's doing is it's making us move faster and make sure that we're only getting the most important data there. So you start to make, you know, you take the time that you have to do something, you shorten it, you take the resources and you shorten it, you make sure that everything that you're doing is forcing you to focus, because if you multitask, the drag on your performance will be visible and clear, right? Drive 95 miles an hour, you won't want to text. I didn't tell you to do that. Okay, reduce the negative impact of the multitasking that you're going to do, right? And that means to choose compatible tasks like we talked about, right? So, for example, there's two ways of thinking about this. One is multi-purposing and one is compatible tasks. So from a multi-purposing perspective, I bike everywhere in New York. And what that does for me is it allows me to get two things done at once, which is I'm getting to where I need to go and I'm getting my exercise. So if I'm biking down to Wall Street from the Upper West Side, I've gotten a 30 minute bike ride in. I don't have to work out. That's my workout, right? So I'm effectively multitasking in a way that absolutely doesn't drag on any kind of performance, right? And then also compatible tasks. If you're, you know, listening to the news or on a phone call while you're folding laundry, those kinds of things, you know, reduce the negative impact of the multitasking, but try to find those places where you can multitask and it'll work effectively. And then avoid dangers, obviously. Like if you're going to text and talk on the phone at the same time, I can't do it. But if you're going to do that, that's much better than driving and texting at the same time. The last is become conscious of your behavior. And these are two things that I'm doing that are helping me to become conscious of my behavior. I set a watch to beep every hour. And on that hour, it beeps. I stop for 1 minute. That means I can work the other 59 minutes of the hour. Everybody who comes to me and says, wow, that's really impossible. There's no way I could do this. My question was, have you tried? And everyone who said that they can't do it has not tried. So my suggestion would be, if this is interesting at all to you, try it. Set your watch, beep for 1 minute every hour. Take a deep breath and ask yourself, am I doing what I most need to be doing right now? That quick interruption, it's eight minutes of interruption during the day, will increase your awareness of whether you're focusing on the things that you need to if you're multitasking or single-tasking. And then finally, 5 minutes in the evening to just stop at the end of the day and say, how did my day go? Let me just wrap it up. What worked? What didn't work? Where did I get off course? Where was I driving at 90 miles an hour and trying to text at the same time? And then what do I plan to do tomorrow and how do I want to do it differently tomorrow? So those are just sort of a few general ideas, right? Which is to understand your environment and make sure that you're creating an environment that makes it more likely that you're going to do the things you want to, less likely than you think you're going to do the things that you don't want to do. to reduce the amount of work that you're doing so that you're focusing on your most important things and there's less temptation to multitask, that you're reducing the amount of time that you're working on things so that you up the ante of it, and that finally, that you're reducing the negative impact. One last thing I want to show you that you can actually learn from these things in terms of your behavior. Say roast 10 times. Roast, 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 roast. What do you put in a toaster? See, you guys are really good. Thank you.
So now we're coming to the talk show portion of our panel. So my first question for you guys is, does gender make a difference when it comes to multitasking?
I'm glad we're all men.
Right, exactly, since you're all men.
Yes, but not for the reasons that you think. So I was once interviewed by somebody from a newspaper in England who wanted me to tell them that women are just definitely born better multitaskers than men. I wouldn't do that, but this person published it anyway. What's true, nevertheless, is you will be good or bad at particular kinds of multitasking depending on the kinds of practice that you have. And if females have more practice under certain conditions while multitasking, they'll look better than men. But if men have more practice under other conditions, they'll look better than women. So it all depends on where one gender or another is getting the most practice at doing a particular kind of multitasking.
And if I get asked that question a lot, and I spend a good amount of time. First of all, in our data, we have never found a difference. We're probably not incredibly well powered in the gender split in our studies to answer it. But in that last lifespan study that I showed you, that was like 240 people, and we didn't see a significant difference. If you really spend some time and go through the scientific literature, it's not convincing that the empirical data supports a gender difference.
Are there people who are simply better natural multitaskers? And if so, who are these people and what makes them better? Like, are there born super multitaskers?
Some people at Utah are now claiming 2% of the population are super taskers. A lot of hype about this, like, for example, in Scientific American Mind. Those people may be better at multitasking than others in the ordinary population, but they're still going to suffer in performing tasks like self-pointing and driving if you measure their performance especially well. So there's a range in terms of natural abilities at multitasking, but nobody is immune. For example, Michael Schumacher, the former Formula One race driver, is not immune to the effects of trying to self-phone while driving at 95 miles an hour on the 35 as you're going through Austin at rush hour.
Yeah, I mean, we see incredible, variability. That's one thing I didn't have time to show you, but if I showed you those performance measures, we'd see some people just do unbelievably well at it in any age group. But in general, everyone has some cost until they get very highly adept at it. Understanding those individual differences, and also you might have that strong ability in one domain, but it might not be in another aspect of multitasking. So there's a lot of interest now in understanding those individual differences and the neural basis for it.
And what I might add is that I see people who are better at managing the environment of multiple tasks without necessarily multitasking, meaning that their minds are such that they can organize a million things, but they're not necessarily doing them all at once.
It's also well known that people that think they're very good at multitasking are the people that are actually a little worse at it, too. Interestingly enough.
And Adam, you talked about how multitasking declines with age, but what about infants and young children and teens, especially those who are growing up in this highly multitask and highly digital world? Does neuroplasticity in their brain, does it help them become better multitaskers?
Yeah, so I showed you the curve from 20 to 80. We're now looking from even 12-year-olds with the same exact task to try to round out that curve. Usually these skills develop, like all what we call fluid cognitive abilities or the type of abilities that use rapid processing and working memory and switching. All that those type of cognitive skills tend to develop, usually peak around 23 years old, if anyone's right in that sweet spot. Count yourself lucky, you won't be there for very long, and then decline fairly linearly throughout your life. So, you know, we think that we could have some control on boosting these abilities when you need to. Obviously, I really strongly agree with structuring your life to make it as optimal as possible. But your brain is plastic and will learn how to deal with multiple streams fairly well, but not usually when you're a young child. This is the prefrontal cortex, the top part that we both talked about, is responsible for this cognitive control, your ability to manage these multiple tasks.
David, have you studied this, or you're good? We've talked about different tasks that don't work very well, multitasking. But what about screen multitasking and screen toggling? I mean, almost all of us are, you know, juggling multiple screens, whether it be multiple monitors or phones, et cetera. And is that more difficult than other forms of multitasking?
Yeah, so this is a big issue that just appeared in the news a few weeks ago. In fact, I got interviewed by Matt Richtel, who won the Pulitzer Prize for his previous New York Times series on cell phoning and driving. Now he's gotten interested in the pros and cons of using multiple computer monitors on your desk all at the same time. And a study came out recently from the University of Utah that was funded by NEC, trying to show that multiple monitors are very beneficial. And, of course, this is like having a study done by a cigarette manufacturing company who wants you to buy more cigarettes. The fact of the matter is, this is a really complicated case where it all depends on how you're using those monitors. I can create situations where having more monitors on your screen is going to improve your efficiency by tons, depending on exactly the kinds of tasks that are devoted to each of the screens, whereas under other conditions, especially if you're quite bad at ignoring stuff that's really irrelevant at the moment, having more monitors is just going to make you be even worse than what Peter was talking about a moment ago. So it comes back again to this verse from the Kenny Rogers song. It's just, you got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them. And there are cases where sometimes you hold them, and in other cases you fold them. And in the latter cases, you unplug your monitors.
You know, I'll share a slightly different perspective, which is that I work with a lot of people who end up with four or five monitors. They're working in a hedge fund environment, or they're working in a technology environment. And what I would say is, again, if you're gonna do it, right? If you know that you're gonna do it, then one of the things that multiple monitors do is they reduce your switch tasking time. So if you have one monitor and you're going to be doing it and you're switching and toggling back and forth and closing windows and opening windows, that's going to take a lot more time than if you've got one screen and you're looking at a report here and you're looking at what the market's doing here in Asia and what the then you know, the multiple screen environment reduces the negative impact of multitasking if you're going to multitask. So I wouldn't disagree that it's better to just focus on one thing at a time, but if you're going to do it, then create the environment that's going to reduce the negative impact of it, which would be multiple screens looking back and forth.
So a really interesting point here is you can actually find out whether under some set of conditions or another it's better to have the multiple monitors by doing the computational modeling that allows you to estimate exactly what are going to be the benefits of the costs or the costs of having the one kind of situation or another. In particular, the Navy funded a lot of the research that I and some of my colleagues at Michigan did because they were concerned about the human factors issues like we're talking about right now, and decided correctly that in order to know exactly what the answers are, you got to have the models that enable you to take account of various kinds of contributions due to not having to toggle so much, needing to make eye movements or not, and so on and so forth, to the overall mix of how much time you're consuming in one kind of environment versus another.
So my perspective on it is that sort of in the data that I showed you where you have to remember a face and then a face pops up in the middle, you have to make a very simple decision about it. I tend to not call these multitasking. I call them interruptions. And the reason why is because when we look at the neural data and we could look at these networks, functional networks between the front part of your brain and the rest of your brain, we see that the networks are broken. They're disrupted by that very simple interruption. And so while I think it, you know, it is somewhat intuitive that if you could decrease the amount of time of the interruption or the ease of interrupting, maybe it has some benefit. But in general, an interruption, a break is a break. And once that network is broken and you want to return to it, you have to reactivate it and reengage it. It's not always trivial. It seems to get harder as you get older to do that. But, you know, I would take the perspective that each interruption, as subtle as it is still a break in that network that you had formed to do what you were doing. And so when you think about it like that, you can almost feel the burden of those switches. And so I'd ask you to think about it from that perspective. That being said, it's not bad necessarily to do. It's the context of what you're doing, and at least from my perspective, I have two tremendous monitors. I frequently switch between tasks all the time. When I'm doing, my personal way of dealing with it is when I'm doing something that is very low, let's say of low importance. I just have a lot of things to do. It's not that difficult. I just need to get them done. I'll multitask away. I find it way more enjoyable. I think the novelty load of multitasking is greater, and I think it's in general more fun. But if I am writing a paper, especially if it's time sensitive or a grant, I will basically work on one monitor and shut my email down. It's very similar to the things that you were saying. Being cognizant of the fact that each of those interruptions breaks the network that I had worked so hard to set up. And so, you know, that's my perspective.
So let me ask you a question, because I agree 100%. And so my question is, would you consider this an interruption, which is multiple screen environment and I'm investing, and I'm trying to make this investment decision, and in order to make it, I need to look at what's happening over here in Asia, and now what's the Dow Jones doing, and over here, what is that news, and et cetera, and then I make this decision over here. So I'm kind of focused on this single task, needing multiple pieces of information that are coming from a bunch of different places. Would that, in your view, be considered multitasking or interruptions or part of a single task?
Yeah, I mean, it gets really complicated, and it's a great, great point. Tasks could be multifactorial and have many components, and then it's probably different, but there is probably still, like, tasks that involve so many streams of information in order to make a decision have a greater burden in themselves. Usually that falls into the category of, like, cognitive load.
Right.
So it's not really considered an interruption as much because it is part of one task, but it has its own burden associated with it of doing it. And I'd also like to distinguish that from having something open on the other monitor that you're not focusing on. That I would call a distraction, right? Like, you just turned off that screen over there. Like, there was nothing to look at there. You already saw that slide. But it is a distraction. So that being another...
That slide,
exactly. That... Reducing that type of interference, which I distinguish in my research from the conscious multitasking, is another way of helping your behavior, I would say.
And Adam, your talk showed fascinating ways that people can improve their multitasking ability. So I just want to talk, like, for, you know, us average Joes who do, we not only want to change our environment, but we also know that we're going to be multitasking. We want to become better and more efficient. I mean, if we were to multitask more, would we actually get better at it?
Yeah, that's the question. That's what we're trying to figure out. So in our work in our lab, we're trying to see if we challenge this, will you get better? You saw what happened to those 60 and 70-year-olds. They certainly got a lot better at it. The question, the really important question that we're trying to follow up is, does that transfer? Is there a way of making your brain more efficient at doing this such that when you do something very different that it also involves interference, you're better at that? That is gold, right? That's really what we want. I mean, getting better at that game is only so good if it doesn't leave there, it's limited.
Right.
There's a study by one of our panelists that was going to join us today, and I'll just give him the quick credit, Cliff Nass and a group at Stanford, to tell you about that data really rapidly. What he did was him and his colleagues collected participants. They gathered a group of participants at Stanford and they filled out a questionnaire and classified them to whereas they were heavy medium multitaskers or low medium multitaskers. So this was all the media that we use, and basically you fill out a questionnaire of how you use these in conjunctions with one another. Then they took the extremes, they brought them into the lab, and they did a series of tests on them, cognitive and psychological tests, to look at their ability to actually resist distraction and to switch between tasks. And what they found was that the heavy medium multitaskers, the people that engage in this behavior more frequently, were worse at these tasks. And It's not causal evidence, and I think that's very important. It doesn't mean that engaging in this behavior leads to this outcome, this correlational data. It could be that people that tend to be more distractible and have these traits are those that multitask. So there's still some really important questions, but it is very provocative to think that there could be chronic consequences of interacting with your environment in this way, and certainly important questions of what happens when it occurs during development. And a lot of these things need long longitudinal studies, and we don't know the answers to.
So can we have the computer back on with my computer?
Yeah, right.
So related to your question, here are results from a 5-session study involving young adults where we tried to teach them to be good at virtually perfect time sharing involving 2 compatible tasks. And what you see here is early in practice, like during session 2, there's a lot of interference on dual task trials, which have the higher reaction times on the vertical axis, but by when you're in session 5, that interference has gone away for most of the subjects. If you make the tasks a little bit more difficult, you discover there are actually 2 groups of subjects who show up after a bunch of practice. There are your good time sharers. There are your poor time sharers. But at least in the case of the good time sharers, they can get rid of most of this interference after about 5 sessions of practice. If you go look across cultures, where one culture will emphasize parallel simultaneous processing more than another, for example, as in East Asia versus North America and Europe, you discover that those subjects who tend towards simultaneous multitasking tend to come more from the East Asian cultures than from the North American cultures, whereas those who tend to do more sequential multitasking come from the other kinds of from the North American European cultures. And the notion is that the culture itself is encouraging you to do one kind of multitasking or another. For example, in East Asia, there's a lot of emphasis in social environments on paying attention to everybody who's there at one time in a scene as opposed to focusing on yourself and or a couple of other people. There's a lot of other stuff about the environment that is encouraging this. And you find that actually showing up subsequently in lab tasks, which is a kind of evidence for the possibility of training to use one style of multitasking or another depending on the kind of extensive practice you get.
So thank you, guys. We're now going to take questions from the audience. And do we have the mic for audience? Okay, great. So if anybody has any questions, sure. Yeah, just have them come up.
Should be on.
Hi. So I'm Dave Kaiser with Dark Matter Consulting. My question for y'all is, okay, so clearly when we're shifting between tasks, there's that performance loss. I'm curious if your research has shown that there's also an increase in stress to the point of, like, you know, even after they're done with the task, people don't feel good. Because I make up that a lot of distractions and shifting, and our brains get kind of frazzled, and then whether we're doing the task well or not, we're still kind of jangled. Thank you.
Yeah, so I'm not sure anybody here has literally studied occurrence of stress and effects of stress in our own labs, but there's a lot of other research out there indicating that this goes on big time under conditions where you really care about doing your tasks well and not committing errors. And the prototypical example is air traffic control, where air traffic controllers, who obviously care a lot because otherwise planes crash and burn out in their 40s and early 50s, and they get depressed and so on and so forth. Essentially, what's going on here is when you're trying to multitask at peak efficiency, you pump yourself up, colloquially. This releases stress hormones, the most notable of which is cortisol. And if you're chronically exposed to unnaturally elevated levels of cortisol, that's basically a kind of poison floating around in your bloodstream that kills brain cells, especially in the parts of the brain having to do with prefrontal cortex, working memory, and the hippocampus, which is responsible for the formation of new long-term memories. And you essentially become a cognitive burnout. And that's it with air traffic controllers. In the old days, the pits of Wall Street had people like that too if they really cared about what their investments were doing. I'm not clear they so much are that way anymore, but back then there was a lot of burnout in those realms too. And there are lots of studies on rats showing that when you induce stress for whatever reason, be it multitasking, you can stick a rat in really cold water over and over again, and the rat will get stressed out. And that's one of the procedures used to induce the release of these stress hormones in the rats. And it's been shown in rats as well as other lower mammals that once you have those stress hormones floating around your bloodstream, your brain's going to become toast. So there's a chain of inference, to wrap up, there's a chain of inference showing that regardless of how you generate your stress, including with the multitasking, it's going to have these negative consequences leading to what you called frazzled brain.
I agree entirely with all that. I mean, one little counter-argument I'd like to say is that we do feel that a little stress is good, though. And, you know, certainly putting yourself in an entirely comfortable situation where you're not challenging yourself or under some stress is probably also not good for your brain. But certainly in high levels, all these aspects of these hormones and their negative effects are true.
Yeah, so there's this thing called the Yerkes-Dodson curve, which basically plots the efficiency of your performance as a function of your arousal level, and it's an inverted U-shaped curve. So obviously, if you're dead, you're not going to perform very well. And if you're so stressed out that you're completely freaked, you're not going to perform very well. And there, somewhere in the middle, there's going to be this sweet spot. And I was talking about the side of the curve where you're sort of freaked out. Adam was talking about the side of the curve where you're kind of laid back. And the real trick is to arouse yourself just enough so that you're sort of at this peak, which is why a lot of performers, in effect, actually like getting slightly anxious before they go on stage, because otherwise they're not going to do their best job. And they know that if they're laid back about a gig, probably that gig ain't going to be so good until they do get aroused by going on stage or wherever and eventually becoming pumped up by the audience. So it's not, again, it's not an either or. There are these trade-offs, and you got to know where to be in terms of the sweetness.
So I would just add, first of all, it's always felt to me that there's never a negative to being aroused, but I do see where you're going with it. And the one thing that I would add is that in my experience, when the stress is related to achieving something effectively, then your brain is less frazzled than when you're failing at achieving that. So, for example, when I said take a one-hour meeting and cut it down to 30 minutes, and you're engaged and you're focused, and the tendency of stress when you're single task is actually you achieve something better and more, faster and more productively. The stress there, you get some feedback that's really positive feedback, which is I've achieved something and I ran that race really fast, and it's kind of good stress. When you're all over the place, then that ends up being very unproductive and you end up with bad stress.
Hi. The focus of the study seemed to be on individuals, but do groups, are they able to multitask and still have a high performance, or how does that relate to an individual?
I think it's a great question. I was actually just having the discussion with our design team on these apps that we're building, and asking the question of what does multitasking look like when you have multiple individuals multitasking. I don't know, have anyone here ever played the game Portal 2? Anything? My girlfriend and I have been playing, and it's certainly very, it's like multitasking two people, like your brains are like combined to, do these tasks. And I don't know of a lot of data on it. I feel like it's very interesting. It's a great question for an interactive session here at South By. So I hope that there is more, but clearly I think a lot of the constraints are very similar, right? You have switch tasks that occur when you're moving between individuals, each contributing to a common goal. So it's something I have not thought a lot about, but I find it really interesting.
Turns out there actually is a growing body of research on exactly this question, about which I knew nothing until 3 weeks ago, when a guy at the University of Michigan who works in the business school there came over and talked to our cognition and cognitive neuroscience group about his research on group decision making, which essentially assigns to individuals parallel threads of activity or not, and has certain kinds of algorithms for combining the individual pieces of information that they're accumulating while they're going about doing their job, and what is most optimal under which conditions for various sizes of groups really depends on the kinds of assignments and strategies that are given to those individuals, in the same way as I was talking about the various sorts of task scheduling strategies for an individual brain. And I don't know all the details of that, but if you send me an email subsequently, I'll point you to the email address of the guy who gave this talk, who apparently is one of the world's experts on exactly these matters, and people do care about them clearly a lot.
I imagine it's the type of thing that could be optimized in a similar way.
That's exactly why they're wanting to do research
on
it.
That's very interesting.
I mean, for example, Microsoft is not all that great at certain kinds of stuff. Apple is better, but it all depends.
Because multitasking is such a societal norm, in addition to sharing the suggestions that you all have today, what other suggestions do you have to help work with and strategize with folks who already still have that idea in mind that multitasking is the best way to do things? What suggestions do you have for working with them in addition to sharing what you have today?
So let me just ask, is your question, how do you convince them not to? Or is your question,
may not have the control to do that. So how do you still work with them effectively when they still think that multitasking is the best way?
And where's it falling down right now?
Like, if they're your supervisor or they're your supervisor's supervisor.
That's where I was headed. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, this is really interesting. How I got into doing these sort of public gigs is a press release was issued about a decade ago on one of my studies showing inefficiency in multitasking, and the employees of CNN picked up on this and turned it into a big news article because they were pissed at their bosses, who were riffing a lot of employees and making all the rest of the ones there do tons of multitasking, and they didn't like it. So they started publishing stuff, in effect, showing what the truth about these matters are. And maybe you could start placing subtle news items on their desks, getting email messages forwarded to them, if there's any way that you can test them yourself under conditions like I did with the young lady back there, to illustrate how it doesn't really work. It's hard because they're under pressure to optimize the bottom line, and they somehow think this is going to work. So you have to expose them to actual real evidence showing that it won't. And I don't know what you do, but I agree that it's not just a problem with you as a worker. It's a problem with the whole society. There's got to be some kind of balance achieved down the road that's going to cut back on the multitasking madness.
I have two quick thoughts. One is, if they're multitasking a lot, that works in your favor because they're going to slow down and then you're going to have more time to do the stuff that you need to do. The second piece is, one idea is to interrupt them when they're in the middle of doing something. Just say, hey, do you mind? And then when they look up exasperated, you could say, yeah, I know, it's like really, really hard to multitask, isn't it? Anyway, here's the thing. And that'll drive the point home.
I'll give myself a shameless plug. I have a show on PBS. It's a single special called The Distracted Mind, and it's all about this topic, both my research and a large issues. And I never thought about it as much from the perspective of an employee thinking about their employer, but I get these emails now of someone like, oh, my God, I'm so excited to share this with my boss. So clearly it's an issue that a lot of people seem to be facing.
We have to sit in. I mean, there are no no way to go without distractions. You've got people coming up behind you. You can see them in your mirror that you got on the wall. You know. Is there any talk about corporate America and changing the way they're set up with cubicles and open doors?
Bose makes these great noise-canceling headsets. It's a very tough issue. I see this all the time. I'm in a lot of conversations with organizations around this. I love the idea conceptually of open workplaces, and I've actually rarely seen them work effectively because people get so distracted that unless it's a very transactional kind of workplace, if you're an assistant and your job is to connect with 10 different people and make, then it always, it's kind of a money-saving thing in order to create the cubicles. The truth is, I don't see them going away. I don't see, organizations moving from open work environments to, closed offices. And I think it's something we're going to continue to have to play with because I empathize with it. It's a really, really tough environment in which to work.
Here's another suggestion. It's kind of sneak attack. If anybody can figure out a way of slip some regular meditation activity by an entire office into the workplace, this will sensitize individuals to the negative vicissitudes of multitasking, but in a way where you're not literally saying multitasking is bad, but by getting people to do something else that is considered to be good at least some of the time. And as you become more trained with the meditation, you'll also be better able to deal with the surrounding environment that confronts you when you're in these cubicles. So
we're closing. Rachel's going to close. I just wanted to do a quick plug myself, which is that I have a book signing at 5 o'clock just outside Ballroom G on the fourth floor of the Convention Center, if anybody's interested.
And thank you all so much for coming. And sorry we couldn't get to all of your questions, but thank you.
Good job.